And to be completely honest with you, I have no idea what happens after we die. I haven't died, at least that I can remember, and I have heard a great number of opinions on what happens after we die from a large number of sources, and none of them have convinced me that they truly, definitively know for certain what they're talking about. They have managed to convince me that they believe they know for certain what they're talking about, but they haven't managed to convince me that they know for certain what they're talking about. So all I have to say is, you know, whatever happens after we die, I guess I'll get to find out someday, or not. But having put out that preface, and also, you know, tonight's sutta sometimes it seems to mess with some people's immortality project. There's a lot of people just, they want to figure out some way they can live forever. There's lots of ways you can do that. Most spiritual traditions, or at least most religions, give you some option. You know, you just be good, or you just believe this, all right? And so a lot of people are running immortality projects. So if you've got an immortality project running, I don't want to mess with your immortality project. I mean, you're going to have to deal with that on your own. Okay? But I'm going to put out what I found in this sutta, which I think is actually quite important. And, well, you get to decide what it means. This is the middle-length discourses, number 38. The greater discourse on the destruction of craving. And like our sutta that I mentioned this morning, that was actually two suttas jammed together to make one, two discourses to make one sutta, this is also two discourses jammed together to make one sutta. They're both about the destruction of craving. The first one is about bhava tanha, craving for becoming, in particular, craving for becoming in the next life. And then the second sutta is about kama tanha, craving for sense pleasures. Okay, and the Buddha has different strategies for overcoming the craving. So, thus have I heard. Once the Blessed One was living at Savatthi in Jetas Grove, Anathapindika's park. This is a very famous monastery. The story behind it is that Anathapindika was a very rich merchant. And he lived in Savatthi, which is the capital of the kingdom of Kosala, sort of in the middle of India. And he went to visit his brother-in-law in Rajagaha, the capital of Magadha, which is more eastern India. And when he got to his brother-in-law's house, he was surprised that everybody was really busy preparing a feast. And so he said to his brother-in-law, well, is the king coming or what? And his brother-in-law said, no, tomorrow the Buddha's coming. The Buddha? You mean someone fully awakened? Yeah, he's coming tomorrow. You got a Buddha in the neighborhood? Yeah, pretty excited. Where is this Buddha? Oh, he's staying in the bamboo grove. Well, I want to go see him. No, you can't go see him. Come on, it's after dark. Just go to bed, he'll be here tomorrow. But Anathapindika really wanted to see the Buddha. And so very early in the morning, he woke up and he couldn't get back to sleep. So he snuck out of the house and he went to the bamboo grove. And he's like, where am I going to find the Buddha? And he's wandering around and he hears a voice that says, Anathapindika, come over here. And it was the Buddha. And the Buddha gave Anathapindika a Dharma talk. And Anathapindika was established in the fruit of stream entry, meaning he arrived at the first level of awakening. And he accompanied the Buddha and the monks back to his brother-in-law's house. And with the meal and another Dharma talk, Anathapindika says, well, for some rains retreat, because at that time in India, the monks, when it was the rainy season, would go into retreat, mostly because they planted the rice at that time, and it was planted underwater. And if the monks went out on alms round, they might step on the rice plants, which would cause a famine. So they stayed in the monastery, and the people in the towns who were supporters, who knew where the rice plants were planted, because they planted them, would bring food. And so Anatapindika says, for the next rains retreat, would you come to Savatthi? And the Buddha says, well, you know, I got a lot of monks. We'd need a place to stay. And Anatapindika says, don't worry about that. I'll find you a place to stay. So when he went back to Savatthi, he looked around and he found a grove that was owned by Prince Jeta. And he went to Prince Jeta and he said, I would like to buy your grove. And Prince Jeta said, not for sale. Anatapindika looked some more, but still, Prince Jeta's was the best. He went back and asked again, not for sale. He looked some more, comes back a third time, ask again. Well, now Prince Jeta is sitting around with a bunch of his buddies. He says, okay, you can have it if you cover the entire ground with a golden coin. Anatapindika says, sold. And Prince Jeta says, no, I was just kidding. And his buddies go, no, you said you'd sell it. We want to see this. So Anatapindika converted one-third of his wealth into golden coins and started covering the grove. And he covered everything except a spot by the door, and he ran out of golden coins. And he was just about to send his servants to get some more, and Prince Jeta says, okay, I'll give you that as a discount. So then Anatapindika built kutis, huts, for the monks to stay in and furnished them. And the Buddha came, and he actually spent 25 of the rains retreats at Savatthi. And so we have lots of discourses that take place at Savatthi. So on this particular occasion, a pernicious view, a very evil view, had arisen in a bhikkhu named Sati, the son of a fisherman. He said, as I understand the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One, it is the same consciousness that runs and wanders through the rounds of rebirth, not another. So he's identifying his consciousness as his self. And he thinks when his body dies, his consciousness goes and finds a new body. And this is a pretty common belief in Buddhism today, as in other religions as well. But a number of bhikkhus heard that he had this belief, and they went to him and they said, do not say this, Sati. The Blessed One has said on many occasions that consciousness is a dependently originated phenomena. But although they questioned and cross-questioned Sati, he wouldn't give up his belief. And so those monks went to the Buddha and told him what had happened. And then the Buddha says, you tell Sati the master calls. And so that monk went and told Sati, the master calls you. And so Sati went to the Buddha, saluted, sat down to one side. And then the Buddha said to Sati, is it true that you think that the way I teach the Dharma, I'm teaching that this very consciousness roams and wanders through the rounds of rebirth? Yes, Venerable Sir, as I understand the Dhamma that you teach, it is this very consciousness which roams and wanders through the rounds of rebirth. What is consciousness, Sati? Venerable Sir, it is that which speaks and feels and experiences here and there the result of good and bad actions. Okay, so your consciousness is that which speaks and feels and experiences the results of karma. But probably a lot of people would agree, yeah, this is consciousness, right? It's the little guy looking out of the eyeballs. He sees what's going on. When he's got something to say, he makes your jaw go up and down, right? When something happens, he's the guy that feels it. And yeah, he gets the results of actions. The Buddha replies, misguided man, to whom have you ever known me to teach the Dhamma in that way? Misguided man, have I not stated in many ways consciousness to be a dependently arisen phenomena? Since without a condition, there is no origination of consciousness. But you, misguided man, have misrepresented us by your wrong view and injure yourself and stow up much demerit for this will lead to your harm and suffering for a long time. I don't think the Buddha agreed with Sati. All right? Then the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus. Bhikkhus, what do you think? Has this bhikkhu Sati, son of a fisherman, kindled even a spark of wisdom in this Dhamma and discipline? No, Venerable Sir. How could he have, Venerable Sir? If you had the wrong idea of what the Buddha was teaching and you went around saying the Buddha teaches this, the Buddha was not particularly pleased about it. When this was said, the bhikkhu Sati, son of a fisherman, sat silent, dismayed, with shoulders drooping and head down, glum and without response. Then knowing this, the Blessed One said to him, "Misguided man, you will be recognized by your own pernicious view." Well, here we are 2,500 years later, and we recognize poor old Sati because of his pernicious view. I shall question the bhikkhus on this matter. Then the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus. Bhikkhus, do you understand the Dhamma taught by me, like this monk Sati? No, Venerable Sir, for on many occasions you have said that consciousness is a dependently originated phenomena. Good, good, bhikkhus. It is good that you understand the Dhamma taught by me in this way. Consciousness is reckoned, is named, on the basis of the conditions on which it arises. If consciousness arises based on eye and sights, it's eye consciousness. On ear and sounds, ear consciousness. Nose and smells, nose consciousness. Tongue and tastes, tongue consciousness. Body and textures, body consciousness. Mind and mind objects, mind objects. Just like a fire is reckoned by the conditions on which it depends. If a fire is burning dependent on a forest, it's a forest fire. If it's burning dependent on a house, it's a house fire. If it's burning dependent on rubbish, it's a rubbish fire. If it's burning dependent on chaff, it's a chaff fire. If it's burning dependent on cow dung, it's a cow dung fire. In just the same way, consciousness is reckoned by the conditions on which it depends. Now, what follows is a set of questions and answers. This set of questions and answers probably was in the original sutta, but it wasn't quite such a long list. Okay? It starts out, bhikkhus, do you see this has come to be? Now, the commentaries go to great lengths to figure out what the this refers to. This has come to be. And they decide that this is referring to the body. But I think all the Buddha is saying is, bhikkhus, when something arises, can you recognize this has come to be? Yes, Venerable Sir. Bhikkhus, do you see? This thing's origination occurs with that as nutriment. Nutriment is the condition. We live by eating food. Food is our nutriment, right? So when something arises, there has to be things that cause it to arise. And can you understand when something arises? It arises due to causes and conditions. It's nutriment. Yes, Venerable Sir. Bhikkhus, do you see? With the cessation of that nutriment, what has come to be is subject to cessation. Yes, Venerable Sir. So now the Buddha is starting to ask questions about what we could call the general view of dependent origination. I referred to it as this, that conditionality. This arises dependent on that. If that does not arise, this does not arise. This is the law of necessary conditions. It's not phrased in the way that we in the West usually think of necessary conditions, but this is what the Buddha is asking the monks about. Do you understand the law of necessary conditions? Things arise, they arise dependent on something. If that something doesn't happen Or if that supporting condition goes away, do you understand that whatever has arisen goes away? Yes, Venerable Sir. And now the questions go on. I don't know how many of them were in the original discourse, but it actually turns into one of the most boring and tedious and long and, things you want to skip through in all of the suttas. So you get dependent origination rising, you get dependent origination ceasing in the forward order, you get recapitulation on dependent origination in the forward order, you get dependent origination in the reverse order, arising and ceasing and recapitulation and reverse order and... Okay. All right. What appears to have happened is that we have this sutta and it has these questions in it. And somebody got the bright idea. Let's put in a few more questions on dependent origination. And somebody said, hey, let's put in a few more, until it just got outright ridiculous. So I don't think all these questions were in the original sutta. Where it actually stops and gets a little crazy, a little difficult to say, but clearly at some point somebody got in here and just added a bunch of stuff. You could see why this would be done. If you were a monk and you were learning the Buddha's teachings, part of that would be to learn the suttas by heart, to recite them, to chant them, so that you knew them. I mean, you didn't have a book, you couldn't look it up on your Kindle, you had to keep it in your head, and you could teach the next generation. And so somebody goes, hey, let's throw in some more questions on dependent origination here, so that the monks, when they learn it, they can learn more. And the idea of preserving exactly what somebody said just simply wasn't part of Indian culture at that time. If you had something to say, often it was a good idea to put it in the mouth of someone who is very prominent. And then whatever you said would, of course, have more weight. And so that's what happened here, apparently. But eventually, it gets back to the original sutta. Bhikkhus, knowing and seeing in this way, that is, in terms of dependent origination, would you run back to the past asking, were we in the past? Were we not in the past? What were we in the past? How were we in the past? Having been what did we become in the past? No, Venerable Sir. Knowing and seeing in this way, in terms of dependent origination, would you run forward to the future, wondering, shall we be in the future? Shall we not be in the future? What shall we be in the future? How shall we be in the future? Having been what shall we become in the future? No, Venerable Sir. Knowing and seeing in this way, would you now be inwardly perplexed about the present, wondering, am I? Am I not? What am I? How am I? Where has this being come from? What will happen to it? No, Venerable Sir. Bhikkhus, are you saying this because I'm your teacher? No, are you saying this from your own experience? Yes, Venerable Sir. Good monks, it is good that you know this from your own experience. Okay, so this is the key point here, right? So Sati thinks his consciousness basically is permanent. It roams and wanders through the rounds of rebirth. And the Buddha goes, no. It's a dependently originated phenomenon. Sati thinks his consciousness is an entity, a thing. And the Buddha's going, no, it arises just from streams of dependently arising phenomena interacting. That's where everything comes from. Now, he doesn't use that term, but he's saying consciousness is a dependently originated phenomenon. And then he starts asking these series of questions on dependent origination to see how much the monks really understand about it. In particular, he wants to know, do you understand necessary conditions, that one thing arises dependent on something else, and if the something else doesn't happen, that doesn't arise. Or if there are supporting conditions for something, like the light switch being on, and that stops happening, the light switch gets turned off, then the whatever it is, the lights get turned off. Yes, yes, we understand that. And then the Buddha talks about this in some general ways, and then somebody throws in a lot more questions. But what the Buddha is saying, basically, is don't go looking for a self that's transmigrating through multiple existences. Right? Sati's looking for it as his consciousness. Remember when I was talking about the five aggregates, the five khandhas? Near the end of the talk, there was the monk who wondered, okay, it seems that none of the aggregates are myself. What self gets the result of the actions done by the not-self? Right? And here we have the Buddha's detailed answer. Don't think in terms of selves. See that there's just dependently originating phenomena rolling on. They're interacting, and that's all that you can find. And so, if you can look at the world that way, if you stop looking at it in terms of entities, and all you see is streams of dependently arising phenomena interacting, then the question, what was I in the past, or what will I be in the future, doesn't actually occur to you. It doesn't make any sense, because the whole idea of postulating a me that's here now that was in a previous life just simply doesn't occur, because you're seeing there's nothing but all these dependently arising phenomena interacting. That's all that's happening. And even in the present, you're not going, do I exist? Don't I exist? You're not looking for entities. You're just seeing dependently arising phenomena interacting. That's all that's there. If you can do this, this leads to the destruction of bhava tanha. There isn't any craving for a future existence. It also leads to the destruction of vibhava tanha. There's no craving to not have a future existence. Existence not really part of the picture. All there is these dependently arising phenomena interacting. Okay? So this is the first part of this sutta. Now what we have, is a bridge between the two suttas. Bhikkhus, the descent of the embryo takes place through the union of three things. Here there is the union of mother and father, but the mother is not in season, and the Gandhava is not present. In this case, no descent of the embryo takes place. Okay, so the Indians at that time had figured out there must be the union of mother and father. No sex, no babies, all right? They also had figured out the mother needs to be in season, all right? If it's the wrong time of the month, you have sex, no babies. But sometimes it's the union of mother and father, and mother is in season, and you still don't get a baby, right? So what's going on? Well, the Gandhava has to be present. All right, so you're wondering, what the heck is a Gandhava, right? It's a celestial musician. Okay. All right, so when the Westerners first encountered Buddhism and they came to this passage, they're like, oh, silly Indians. They think there has to be a celestial musician playing music when the couple is having sex if you're going to get a baby. And then they decided, oh, actually the word Gandhava means the being to be born. And if you look into the commentaries, that's what you find the explanation. Right? The Gandhava is the being to be born. There's some Well, it's not consciousness, the Buddha just said. It's something. Right? So there's something hanging around called a Gandhava, and it's got to be present. Okay, now it's really clear. Well, no, it doesn't make any sense at all. Right? If we postulate it as a thing, it's clearly not consciousness, because the Buddha has specifically said that's not the case. And if it's an entity of any sort, the Buddha is saying, no, look at everything as dependently arising phenomena. Right? So what did the writer of this bridge, because I don't think this comes from the Buddha, what did they actually mean by the Gandhava? Did they mean a celestial musician? I mean, the Indians had figured out, yeah, you got to have sex, it's got to be the right time of the month, but even that doesn't always make it happen. All right, so we don't know exactly what it means. All right, so if it's union of mother and father, wrong time of the month, no Gandhava, no baby. All right. Here there is the union of mother and father, and the mother is in season, but still no Gandhava is present. In this case, no descent of the embryo takes place. Still no baby. But if there is the union of mother and father, and the mother is in season, and the Gandhava is present, then through the union of these three things, the descent of the embryo takes place. Okay, so now you've got a pregnant woman and a baby starting to grow. The mother carries this embryo in her womb for 9 or 10 months with much anxiety and as a heavy burden. Then at the end of 9 or 10 months, the mother gives birth with much anxiety and as a heavy burden. Then when the child is born, she nourishes it with her own blood, for the mother's breast milk is called blood in the noble one's discipline. Huh? That seems really kind of strange. This whole bridge just really doesn't fit in with what's gone before. And, I mean, it's just really kind of weird. I think what happened, there was the Buddha's discourse on Bhava Tanha with Sati, the son of the fisherman. And after the Buddha asked the monks, are you saying this because I'm your teacher? And they say no. Are you saying it from your own experience? And the Buddha says, good. End of discourse. And then there's another discourse, which starts right after this, on the destruction of kama tanha, craving for sense pleasures. And when they went to put them together, they had to have something to put them together. And so they invented this little bit right here, which contradicts the first sutta and doesn't add anything to the discourse. So the scholars are basically saying we got two suttas and a little bridge in between that doesn't make a lot of sense. And the first sutta has been tampered with a whole bunch of extra questions thrown in. When you're studying the suttas, there's a lot more work to do than just reading them. And there's not a lot of that work that has been done. There's a few books out on that. If anybody's interested in that, I can give them some names of some books to look at. But it's really just beginning to be started. It's been something I've been very curious about, because I've always been much more interested in what was the Buddha actually teaching, rather than what is Buddhism actually teaching. And so I've been trying to do research, but I have a degree in mathematics. I don't have a degree in Pali. I don't even know Pali, hardly. So, yeah, it's a very amateur undertaking. But as far as I can tell, we've got two suttas with a later composition of a bridge to tie them together. And then the second sutta starts. When this child grows up and his faculties mature, the child plays at such games as toy plows, tip cat, somersaults, toy windmills, toy measures, toy carts, and a toy bow and arrow. When he grows up and his faculties mature still further, the youth enjoys himself provided and endowed with the 5 chords of sense pleasure, with forms cognizable by the eye, sounds cognizable by the ear, odors cognizable by the nose, flavors cognizable by the tongue, tangibles cognizable by the body, that are wished for, desired, agreeable, likable, and connected with sense desire and provocative of lust. Okay, so when a little kid is born, they don't have any idea what's going on, right? There's just, sensory input, but no real capacity to interpret it. They say that a child doesn't even distinguish between itself and its mother for several months, right? It's just a lot of sights and sounds and unpleasantness if you're hungry or your diaper's wet or whatever, okay? And you quickly learn that if it's unpleasant and you make noise, things get better, right? And so, and then eventually you start getting the maturing faculties and you start being able to play with toys and find pleasure through the senses. This is basically what's saying. On seeing a form with the eye, one lusts after if it is pleasing, one dislikes it if it is displeasing, one abides with mindfulness of the body unestablished, with a limited mind, and does not understand as it actually is, the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom, wherein those evil, unwholesome states cease without remainder. This phrase, deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom, is referring to waking up, becoming enlightened. Engaged as one is in favoring and opposing, whatever Vedana one experiences, whether pleasant or painful or neither, one delights in that Vedana, welcomes it, and remains holding to it. Which seems kind of weird. I mean, if it's an unpleasant one, one doesn't delight in it or welcome it or remain holding to it. I think the sutta may have been tampered with a little bit too much right here. Think what the Buddha actually is saying, whatever Vedana one experiences, one likes it if it's pleasant and wants to hang on to it and wants to push it away if it's unpleasant. As one does so, delight arises in one. Now, delight in Vedana results in clinging, with clinging as condition, becoming, with becoming as condition, birth, with birth as condition, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair come to be. Such is the origin of this whole mass of dukkha. So we get a little bit of dependent origination here. There are Vedana, right? Pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. And if we're not careful, we take delight in them by craving, craving for the good stuff, craving for the absence of the bad stuff. And this leads to clinging, becoming, birth, old age, sickness, death, pain, sorrow, grief, lamentation, despair, and the rest of the dukkha. As I said last night, the key part of dependent origination in its traditional multiple link form is Vedana, well, sense contact, Vedana, craving, clinging, and then that eventually leads to dukkha. And here we have the becoming and birth inserted in there. And then this is repeated for each of the other senses, hearing a sound, smelling a smell, etc. And then the Buddha says, here, a Tathagata arises in this world, who teaches a Dhamma which is good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end. Someone hears the Tathagata, gains faith, goes forth, keeps the precepts, guards the senses, mindful of all they do, content with little, abandons the hindrances, and then practices the jhanas. After practicing the jhanas, on seeing a form with the eye, one does not lust after it if it is pleasing. One does not dislike it if it is displeasing. One abides with mindfulness of the body established, with an immeasurable mind, and one understands as it actually is the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom, wherein these evil, unwholesome states cease without remainder. So it's interesting, this time the gradual training only goes as far as the jhanas. It doesn't really talk about insight practice or ending the asavas. But it implies that having practiced the jhanas, having had the experience of the pleasure of the four jhanas, one generates pleasure that's better than sense pleasure, and also generates mindfulness. Mindfulness that's good enough so that one doesn't get caught in craving and clinging. One has mindfulness so that one experiences the pleasant vedana and enjoys it, and that's it. And one experiences the unpleasant vedana and deals with the situation, and that's it. Having thus abandoned favoring and opposing, whatever vedana one experiences, whether pleasant or painful or neither, one does not delight in that vedana, welcome it, or remain holding to it. One doesn't get caught up in the vedana. One doesn't experience the craving and clinging. And again, I think the sutta has been a little bit tampered with here. Probably chants better with what's actually here, but it doesn't quite make sense with the unpleasant there. Anyhow, as one doesn't get engaged in whatever's going on, so delight in vedana ceases. With the cessation of this delight comes the cessation of clinging. With the cessation of clinging, the cessation of becoming. With the cessation of becoming, the cessation of birth. With the cessation of birth, the cessation of aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, despair. Such is the cessation of this whole mass of dukkha. So if you experience a vedana and you don't get caught in the craving and clinging, this leads to the end of the dukkha. And then we get the extra bits of dependent origination thrown in there with the becoming and birth. And then the same thing is repeated for each of the other senses. So the solution to kama tanha, craving for sense pleasures, is to experience the jhanas and realize that's a better pleasure, and also to establish mindfulness. Coming out of the fourth jhana, remember it says that one has mindfulness fully purified by equanimity. And so with an equanimous mindful mind, when one experiences vedana, one doesn't get trapped in the craving and clinging, and then there's no dukkha. And then the sutta concludes, Bhikkhus, remember this discourse of mine briefly as the deliverance in the destruction of craving. But remember the Bhikkhu Sati, son of a fisherman, is caught up in a vast net of craving. Poor old Sati. This conclusion, I think, was again composed later. This is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So, the key thing, I think, in this sutta, the thing that I find most important about it, is that when Sati thinks that his consciousness is an entity that goes from lifetime to lifetime, the Buddha says, no, consciousness is dependently originated. Look at the world in terms of dependent origination. He doesn't actually use the phrase, see that there's nothing but streams of dependently arising phenomena interacting, but I think that's what he's pointing at. If you can see the world that way, you manage to step beyond thinking of entities, and when you're not thinking about entities, you're not wondering, was I in the past, what will I be in the future, or anything like that. You're just seeing that there are these streams of dependently arising phenomena interacting.
It sounds like a lot of scriptures you can't really trust. What scriptures, what suttas and scriptures can you trust from the Buddhism?
Yeah, right. So if some of this stuff is questionable, what can you trust? I think what you can trust is not so much, okay, this one's good and that one's good. It's more, read a lot of them and see what practices the Buddha is telling you to do, and go do those practices. I think that's the most important part. Rather than trying to take anything as history or metaphysics or anything like that, take the suttas as practice instructions and go actually do the practices. And, you know, there's a sutta, it's number 123 in the middle length discourses. It says when the Buddha was born, he walked 7 steps to the north and said in a loud voice, basically, I'm king of the world, this is my last birth. Now, I'm sorry, I just have trouble believing in walking, talking newborns, all right? So there's mythology in there. So yeah, all right, we can't accept it all. There's clearly stuff in there that was to promote the Buddha, to make him, you know, more of a god, stuff like this. There's stuff in there to go against other religions. So that's why I say the key stuff is to look at the practices and see what the practices are telling you to do. And then as you do the practices, you begin to get a sense of, all right, what's in harmony with what I'm learning from these practices and what really doesn't seem to be in harmony. I do have on my website a database of suttas that I collected. Just finding in various places on the web translations into English of suttas that were freely available. I got a lot of them from the website Access to Insight and a lot of them from suttacentral.net. And so I made this database of about 2,000 suttas. And one of the projects that I have on my list of projects to do is to go through and tag each of the suttas, whether I think it's early and then perhaps a bit more trustworthy, or late, maybe not so trustworthy, or a composite of early and late. So some parts are trustworthy and some parts, got to look out for it. Or don't know. And the majority of the suttas will wind up in the category don't know. Okay? So it would be interesting to go through that database and do exactly this. There's also a book by Govind C. Pandey. It was his doctoral thesis from the early 50s at an Indian university. And he goes through all the suttas, pointing out what he thinks is early, late, composite, or don't know. And so I would tag these with my idea and his idea. You could see where we agree or disagree. And then you could look at what I think are the early suttas and read them and get a sense of what they're teaching. And then you can look at all the other suttas and see which are in harmony with that. But yeah, there's not a definitive list at the moment that goes, all right, this is probably what the Buddha was saying, because we really haven't figured all that out yet.
Probably the best thing is to go to the person who have been enlightened today following Buddha's path and see what have they done to...
Yes. This is exactly the best thing to do. The only problem is finding the enlightened people. We seem to be in serious short supply on this planet right now. Yeah.
Topic for another talk, but can you briefly tell the different levels of awakening, like what?
Yeah, so
I'm not familiar with them.
Okay, so the 4 levels of awakening. The first level goes by the name stream entry, and it means you've entered the stream that will carry you eventually to enlightenment, to full awakening. There are actually multiple ways that this is defined in the suttas. The traditional way is looking at the 4 levels of awakening in terms of 10 fetters, 10 things that bind us to the wheel of samsara. It is said that at stream entry it uproots 3 of these fetters. The most important one is a belief that you have a self. So this is uprooting the wrong view of self. So you've actually had an experience. You've actually had an experience without an experiencer. And you've experienced, ain't nobody home. And so then you don't believe there's anybody home. Only problem is it still feels like there's a self. And you keep forgetting. And then you, oh yeah, right, I forgot. All right, so uprooting the wrong view of self is the number one fetter at stream entry. The second one is uprooting the belief in the efficacy of rites and rituals. That is, that rites and rituals can get you enlightened. Because you get to stream entry not by doing rites and rituals, but by doing meditation practice. And then the third one is that's uprooted is doubt. You did what the Buddha told you to do. You got the result he said you were going to get. What's the doubt? All right, so that's the first level. It is said that one who reaches the level of stream entry has at most 7 more lifetimes. Okay? And it is also said that one who reaches the level of stream entry will never be reborn below the level of the human realm. You won't be born in hell or a hungry ghost or an animal. You'll either come back as a human or as one of the multiple levels of devas. Okay? I don't know how much I want to give that, all right? But that's the tradition. And the second level is called a once returner. And it basically, the once returner traditionally says that if you die as a once returner, you will return only one more time to the human realm before you become fully awakened. All right? So, yeah, you're getting pretty close. And that weakens 2 more fetters. The fetters of, usually translated as greed and hatred, but literally passion for pleasure and ill will. And they're weakened. All right? And then the third level of awakening is called a non-returner. And that uproots greed and hatred, or uproots passion for pleasure and ill will. But there's still 5 fetters left that are only uprooted at the final stage of awakening. And they are desire for form and desire for formless, which is usually interpreted as desire for rebirth in worlds of form or desire for rebirth in formless worlds. But it just says desire for form and desire for formless. It doesn't say any, there's no more detail given anywhere in the suttas. And then the last 3 are ignorance, restlessness, and conceit. And conceit means conceiving of a self. The fact that at the first level you saw there wasn't actually a self, it still feels like it until you get to the 4th level, and then you don't no longer feel like there's a self here. And that's full awakening. Now, this once-returner and non-returner, those words were already in the culture at the time of the Buddha. In the Upanishads, they talked about that if you were really good, maybe when you died, you could have union with the sun. Now remember, the sun is considered a god. It's not a nuclear explosion. Right? It's a god. And so when you die, you get union with that god. But because you were only pretty good and not really good, when you die there, you have to come back once to the human realm. But then, when you die the next time, you get union with the sun again. And when you die there, you get union with Brahma, right? So, once returner has union with the sun and then comes back. But then the next time, they're a non-returner. And they have union with the sun and they don't come back. When they die that time, they get union with Brahma and they've done it all, right? Of course, that's in the Upanishads. Well, the Buddha was quite frequently taking terms from other traditions and changing what they meant. And he seems to have taken once-returner and non-returner out of the Upanishads and give them a different meaning. It's just levels of this awakening. What's interesting is looking at the suttas and finding that the Buddha just woke up. Never mentions him going through any of the other levels. Those five ascetics, they all got to the first level of awakening, and then they got fully awakened. Never got to the middle two. All right, and then you find other people getting, you know, various levels and so forth. So traditionally, it's about uprooting these fetters. And all of these levels of awakening are experiences without an experiencer. But each time it happens, it's a more profound experience. That's why it uproots more of these fetters. So that's the traditional understanding. The way that you get there, yeah, you practice, you get enough insights so that you're actually really willing to let go. And at some point you actually do let go and you have that experience without an experiencer. And you might repeat it at the same level a few times and then hopefully you let go more and you have a more profound experience moving up through the levels of awakening. So this is a traditional understanding. The good news is the instructions never change at whatever level you're at. So it doesn't really matter what level you're at. It's all just, yeah, keep practicing, keep doing what you're doing, it's working, until you finally become fully awakened, right? And then you don't have to practice anymore. So. Anything else?
Well, just the obvious point that, I mean, there is, it's problematic that you could come back as if there's someone that can come back
right.
in another life.
Yeah. Yeah, this is definitely a problematic thing. If there's nobody to come back, then how do you come back? Right? There's a sutta in, again, in the Connected Discourses. It's book 22, number 85, where Yamaka, I think he was a relative of the Buddha, he believes that when a fully awakened person dies, that's the destruction of the self, right? So there's a self around, and it keeps coming back, but when you're fully awakened and you die, then the self is destroyed. And the monks go to him, and they try and convince him, and he won't give up his view. And this time they go to Sariputta, and Sariputta goes to him, and gives him a discourse on the five aggregates and points out he can't find a self in the Buddha, even though the Buddha's still alive. And then Venerable Yamaka gives up his pernicious view and becomes fully awakened. So it's very clear a fully awakened person doesn't have a self. So if there is a self to start with, when does it go away? Well, at stream entry, you saw it wasn't there to begin with. So it must have not ever been there. So if there's not a self, who comes back? Well, it turns out that question is just like, which way does the fire go when the fire goes out? It doesn't really make any sense. And the way you see it doesn't make any sense is you look at the world as nothing but dreams of dependently arising phenomena interacting, and there's no selves or entities or coming back or anything like that. You don't run back to the past, you don't run to the future, you're not even inwardly perplexed about the present. But that question still keeps coming up.
There are all sorts of nice ways around it, like it's a wish or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, the orthodox view is in Theravadin Buddhism that there's rebirth consciousness. So when you die, there's rebirth consciousness, that's the Gandhava, which goes on to the next. But of course the Buddha's going, yeah, not consciousness. So, as I said, people have these immortality projects, And the Buddha's teaching is kind of threatening to people that have immortality projects. So there's this real temptation to just sort of change the Buddha's teaching just slightly so that you can live forever. And the Buddha's going, you're not really here in the first place. There's just this intersection of streams of dependently arising phenomena.